Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 18th, 2018, and welcome to episode 166 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, stock levels, and all kinds of interesting things. Snow, rain. Joining me today are two other retro computing enthusiasts. Out in Portland, Oregon, we have Earl Evans. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing good. And as far as the weather goes, I had some snow this morning, but it didn't stick because the temperatures are too high for it to actually hang around. But it was pretty watching it come down. Usually we have rain, but today I had a little bit of snow, so just thought I'd throw that in.
That's kind of pleasant. Yeah, in Boston, we had kind of a lot of snow last night, but then it's going to be like 60 degrees or something tomorrow, so it's just all going to go away. I really don't envy the people who had to shovel in that brief window of time when there was actually snow.
Just for one day. Yeah,
it's so frustrating, but fortunately, that is not me. And over in a more snowy land of Sweden, we have Jack Nutting. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing pretty good. And yeah, we do have a bit of snow here in Stockholm. Not too much. It's actually quite nice. We have a little sort of light dusting of snow the past couple of days. Kind of like it's always like a little bit coming down all the time, it feels like. Mm-hmm. And it's just a couple of degrees below freezing, so it sticks to the ground. But like I haven't had a shovel. There's not enough snow to shovel, but just like enough to make it look kind of nice. So that's what I like.
Yeah, exactly. So we are here, and I'm your host. I didn't say who I am, but I'm always the same person. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am in charge of the host topic today, although it was actually suggested by Earl, I will reveal. But the topic that I wanted to talk about, or we wanted to talk about, I guess, is part of the fun of retro computing in the modern age is sort of seeing what we can do with the new technology to sort of bring new life to the old hardware that we had, get it to do things that weren't possible before, or, you know, were difficult to do, or, you know, relied on something that was expensive or rare. And, you know, now that it's actually easier to make things with, like, PCB design software and fabrication houses and things like that, it's sort of achievable for people to start their own projects and design their own things and then share them and make them and sell them. And that's great, but then all of these are amateur projects, you know, generally taken in by hobbyists, sharing among friends, essentially, and not businesses that you can rely on to always have stock. And so that's the issue is basically just thoughts about this situation where we have some really interesting hardware that people are making that are briefly available and then go away. So there are a few such things. And this happens a fair amount with, like, there's a couple of examples that I know of on the Apple II where there's this very sought-after flash card solution, the CFFA 3000, Compact Flash for Apple 3000. And this is a card that's made in, you know, that has gone through, I think we're starting the fifth run soon, and the guy who makes it, Rich Dreher, he orders the parts, and in the previous runs, he, I think, assembled them himself, you know, I mean, like, he'd order 100 of these, and then they'd sell out, and then it would be like a year and a half while, you know, waiting lists were compiled, and then the next set would be out, and in that dry spell, of course, you look on eBay, and you find them selling for three times what they would normally sell for new, and it's something that I think we all kind of, a challenge we face in this hobby, is that we see these things, and if they look interesting, we have to get them immediately. So Anyway, I'll stop talking, and maybe Earl, did you have something you wanted to start with on this?
Well, I had a couple thoughts on it. You've described the problem well, that you've got a retro computer community that creates really fun things, and oftentimes they're very popular and everybody wants one, but then, like you mentioned, they run out. You can't get them anymore. And so part of the problem is that it takes time and effort to do production runs of these things, and money also. So you're investing several different things to get these things out to people who want them, just like any manufacturing effort, except like you mentioned, we're not doing this full-time. We're hobbyists. And another aspect of this is that kind of by nature, we're still fragmented into communities. You've got the Apple community, the Atari, the Commodore, the Sinclair, the IBM PC, and then you know smaller niches running around too. Oh, and I should mention one area that there's been a lot of activity in over the last couple of years, the TRS-80 community with some of the cool stuff, and the TI-99/4A community. So all of those have had great hardware additions out there that you can buy, but then all of these communities kind of stick to themselves. I mean, there's not one store like Retro R Us kind of thing that you could go to and buy these things. And I kind of wonder, actually, I'll stop rambling here and see if I can focus on some solutions. I wonder if there could be like a Retro R Us sort of scenario, or at least some way for the various people who build these things to collaborate on certain logistical challenges that they all face. For instance, you mentioned that in some of these cases, the people who create these things also assemble them, but I know that there are assembly services that you can buy, in particular offshore assembly services, where they have a bill of materials, they have a PCB design, and the next thing you know, you have a product. And in some cases, it's cheaper and faster to go with that than it is to sit there with a soldering iron for 2 weeks on end and try and build these things. Another thing is that sometimes these designs are made in an open source fashion where the PC board files and the bill of materials and the code for whatever microcontroller or processor or whatever is in these things gets open. And I've seen lately in a couple of different areas where that saved the day, because even though the people who were originally making the products weren't doing them anymore, some other people stepped up because they could, because everything was open source, and they built it for the hobbyist community. So maybe some combination of centralized resources and logistics, like maybe sharing a storefront on the internet and having a go-to set of fab houses that you could use when you're producing these things, and having the materials and the code of how to build them published publicly, so that when you're not in the mood to make them anymore, somebody else could make them. And, you know, I get it. I mean, I'm a hobbyist and I go through phases myself, and I've built a board or two, and I know how much work that was. I can't imagine building 100 of them or 200 of them. I'd be pulling what little hair I have left out of my head. So, you know, sharing some things on logistics, I wonder if that's a solution to help get us there, because a couple of the things that I've seen, particularly like in Commodore space, Jim Brain's storefront that he has, you can go and you can pretty regularly buy the things there that he has on sale. I'm not sure exactly how he does it, but it's one of those cases where, you know, they'll occasionally run out, but usually you can go, and if you want a Zoom floppy, or if you want one of the Easy Flash cards or something like that, you can get one. So if the various people who made these things kind of got together and said, hey, let's pool our efforts so that when you want one of these, you can kind of almost like printing on demand, you can make one to order. Those are some of my thoughts.
Yeah. Jack, was there anything you wanted to highlight?
Not so much. I think I've been thinking a lot about, when we start talking about the topic here, just this notion of, like you said, Earl, there are a number of designs that are open source. And one thing that kind of occurred to me was that there's probably an opportunity here for some enterprising company, say one of these shops that does do the manufacture of, maybe does manufacture PCBs and or does assembly of objects based on having a PCB and a bill of materials. Like, they could perhaps try and find a way to make it easy to do. So, like, say you have your, I forget the format of the PCB. We call it PC board, is that what it's called, like the file format?
I think there's a couple of different formats in that space. I'm not sure which is the most popular. I haven't worked with it.
So, like, imagine that you had a way of saying, okay, I'm going to have this file, and it's hosted in this GitHub repo or whatever, along with the bill of materials in some format, and that in such a way that if you could just, like, sort of click a link and say, hey, company X, whoever you are, build me one of these things that's described at this URL, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and it can seem kind of far-fetched, but looking at the way, again, with something like GitHub, there are so many software services that are keyed off of working with GitHub, that why not have things that are sort of tangentially moving on towards hardware as well? That we
so could have. You're kind of talking about DevOps for hardware, it sounds
yes.
like.
Yes. Like, it's nothing that I could set up, nothing that I could do, but, like, it's something that somebody could do. I don't know if there's a market enough for it to make it worthwhile, but maybe. Because, like I said, there are a number of these things that might be more or less open source projects, or at least are available in some sort of, you know, available on the internet for free in some way or another. But it is an effort to sort of say, okay, wow, I have this thing and it's got all these parts, and where am I going to find the stuff, and am I competent to even do this, and how do I find this offshore company to assemble it for me? You know, it's a lot of wide open questions that somebody can come along and say, hey, here's a solution. All you need to do is, you know, hook us up with your board description and bill of materials, and we'll give you a few options. Mm-hmm. You know, either that we'll print the board and send you the board and all the materials, or we'll put it together for you, or whatever. You know, it could be, and even that, the even pricing of that could be more or less automated based on the complexity of the board, the amount of materials. They could say, okay, given this thing that you just, you know, that's at this URL, well, that's going to cost you $25 shipped or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sort of spitballing here.
Yeah, and, you know, if there's economies of scale, they could maybe even do something like a minimum order quantity to say mm-hmm. that we will take orders for this, and when we hit 50 orders or 100 orders or something like that, then we'll actually kit them out and build them. Mm. And so you might be waiting in a queue for a little while, or like you said, if there was some sort of an automated pricing structure, maybe it could say, hey, if I only have 5, the cost is going to be X. If you can get it to 25, then the cost will be less, and that
right.
kind of thing. So if you wanted to, you could go, well, I really kind of want it now, so I'll mm-hmm. pay the 1 each price as opposed to the 100 each price, and
right.
actually have the thing. You know, it might cost me 40% more to get it, but I can get it, and it's better than what Paul was describing earlier with the 3x sort of multipliers that you see for some of these unobtainium items on eBay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so it sounds like, I mean, like, the idea is, like, a lot of these independent services kind of, you know, exist, except that I wouldn't know how to start. I mean, like, I know how to look for Osh Park, right? And I know how to look for Shapeways. I don't know where to look for an assembly house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. I know DigiKey exists, you know, like having something that could coordinate this under a single button would be nice. Although I think, so one of the other things is it's actually sort of obvious about these when you start, you know, looking at these things that people sell, you know, make and sell, is that they seem expensive. And then, you know, you hear people commenting, oh, this is, you know, this is great, but, oh, I don't, $120, that seems like a lot. And it would probably be more expensive if we put another entity in between. But at the same time, it also takes the responsibility away from the person who designed it, because it it sort of feels to me like a lot of those comments are pretty unfair. I mean, it's like they can't build this thing for less than $90. They're selling it to you for $100. What do you want?
Totally. No. Totally. Yeah. I know some of these things are expensive and, if not just the parts, I mean, if you've built one of these kits before, you realize that even for a simple kit, there's a pretty decent amount of time investment to mm-hmm. put all the parts on the board and solder it without breaking anything. Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. I know. I have this. I know I mentioned before this game controller that I bought from EdLadden.com two years ago. And I remember I was talking about this and I posted it on Twitter and a friend of mine said, oh, well, that seems really expensive for what you got. And I mentioned that to the guy. I emailed the guy at EdLadden. He actually sent me back his bill of materials of what he spends, the cost. He just don't give the cost for each individual item. And that's when he's buying parts, at scale. He's buying them in the hundreds or whatever. And like his actual markup, like on this thing that costs whatever it costs, $150, like he maybe earned $10 on it or something. If even that, like it was really quite minimal when you consider the cost of like, the metal box and the soldering and the time it takes to make everything, even if it's not electrically complicated, there's a lot of sort of pieces to it that it takes time to find all that. And yeah, I think that like it's people underestimate just how much time it takes to figure out all the logistics of these things. Whereas those who are doing it all the time, it's kind of a no brainer. Like they say, oh, sure, we've got all these things, we can put this together.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. So like the assembly line, right? I mean, like it's why everybody doesn't make their own thing. You just task out the things that are common, so the experts do the thing that they're good at.
Right.
Well, and actually, this is part of the reason I thought it'd be good to brainstorm this on the podcast here, because you guys are giving me some other ideas too. Like for instance, this concept of design for manufacturing, make something that's not just functional but is easy to build. If you had these various communities collaborating with each other on what parts to use and what sort of board designs to use to make the thing easier and cheaper to build, then you might get things that do the exact same thing, but just wind up being cheaper and easier in the long run because you built it with the idea that I don't just want to make a thing, I want to make a thing that's easy to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I think we may have something like this came up in discussion before. I think we're kind of thinking about it. It's a fun project. To someone who's not an expert in this, but kind of wants to learn, like how do I make a PCB? How do I make a thing, put a thing together and make it work? But then you do wind up with people who don't have a lot of electronics expertise coming up with something, that does something really useful that everybody wants. And you don't want to get rid of the fun of doing that project at the same time. It takes it a little bit out of the hobby range if what you're trying to do is optimize parts and so forth. But maybe there could be a sort of a screening board that could look at what you did and said, okay, no, that's really cool. But
well, it does maybe take a little bit of the fun out of it from a prototyping standpoint. I get that. But if I was building something, and I don't have any kind of project like this on the board, it's at this point at least it's probably beyond me. But if I was trying to build something like this, I would be interested in not just learning how to make it functional, but what sort of tricks do the quote unquote experts use when they're making something like this so that it comes out really cool and easy to build. I would think that would be part of the fun, is that I'd have an opportunity to learn. If I was trying to go out and research all that stuff all by myself, that would not be fun. That would be like, that'd be a real climb. But if I'm working with a bunch of like-minded individuals that are all sharing their expertise in that and mentoring each other, then I could see that being kind of a blast. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually, I was sort of half thinking as we were talking about the fabrication, like the sort of like one button fabrication coordination that it might make prototyping a little more complicated. Because, I mean, like, usually the way these projects work is you lay out the board, you send off your order to Osh Park and get it back and find out that, you know, actually there's three things that didn't work, and you have to fix your board and send it out and get it back. And, you know, somewhere there has to be, that step has to still be taken before you set it up to be, like, created and by the sort of one-button machine. And it might be interesting to have also kind of like a similar kind of things for supporting prototyping, you know. What are good, you know, so that's where that community could be, like, mm-hmm. you know, so, like, here's the thing, and you could sort of critique each other's. I mean, it's quite possible that there exists already, like, a Stack Exchange for this, but, actually, one other thing I wanted to mention, too, just sort of in the cost of the thing, is that every once in a while I forget this, but when thinking about this CFFA 3000 thing that, you know, goes in several runs, I think this next, they're hoping... The guy who's making that is hoping to have a new run at the end of the month, end of February, and it's going to be a run of 500. And so when you think about that, that is an enormous amount of money that he's sinking into this up front. And then he's going to be sitting on 500 of these, and if they don't sell, what's he going to do with, like, 200? So, I mean, I think this particular one will sell, but even at smaller scales, it's a lot to ask to say, well, can you put up $200,000, you know, to get these things in the first place and then sell them off?
Yeah, yes, indeed. 500, you say? And what is the retail of a CFFA 3000?
I think they're around 130, 150, something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't do the math, so I have no idea what the actual number is, but
it's
a lot.
That's a decent amount of investment. It sure is.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's one other advantage of some kind of print on demand, you know, of a device, is that conceivably you don't have these stock problems. Cause I could see that really being a obstacle, is, you know, lots of people want them, but not enough. And you have to guess. I don't know. I know that there are a couple of, places that have tried to, the one I'm thinking of is Ultimate Apple II. Reactive Micro, Ultimate Micro. There's some combination of those words that that are a store that sells Apple stuff. But they have new power supplies that you can use in most models of Apple II, and there's various other things. But they also have taken on kind of a couple of external people and sell through their store. And I think actually there's a disk imager that should be coming out fairly soon that I think they're also going to be selling through their store. So they're doing a little bit of some of that front end, you know, the front end marketing.
Are they the ones that were going to do that new Mockingbird clone also? Is that Reactive Micro? I thought it was.
Yeah. And actually you're right. That is a third party who made that. I forget, but it was sort of made by someone else, and they are selling it through their store. So I mean, like, there have been some efforts to try to consolidate. I mean, I think they've been pretty good about trying to, you know, sort of assist other people who are looking to sell their stuff but don't want to set up a whole storefront.
Very cool. Yeah. That's one step towards, you know, this kind of nirvana that I'm thinking about here.
Well, for those of you listening, if you were frustrated by listening to us talk about it when you know the right answer, tell us the right answer.
Absolutely.
And we will share it with
you. You know where to find us.
Right. Okay, so I will move on now then to a couple of points of listener feedback. So there's a bunch of things that I kind of want to mention. And again, sometimes these things are a little hard to distinguish from just news. But so Tony wrote to tell us about a build-your-own Z80 computer that the Center for Computer History, it's like a workshop that they're running. And it seems pretty cool. The places are already sold out. So you can't go, but I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to see. Well, you can go if you got a ticket in time, I guess. But
it's so cool that it's sold out too.
Yeah,
that's just this whole thing is so neat.
Yeah, so it's a little bit like just kind of a workshop where there are kits that you buy to actually sort of build a computer based around a Z80 processor, but, you know, and they just solder it together and, you know, to sort of do this as a community. I've been at something sort of like this. I think they do this at VCF events, and there was something like this. There's often something like this at Kansas Fest, where it's just a room full of people soldering and like helping each other and stuff. Very cool. So it's kind of neat that this is just kind of an available thing that they're doing. I suppose it's possible that makerspaces and things do this, but nobody emailed us about those. So, okay, another one was Mikai wrote to remind us that there is a book called, well, it's often referred to as 10 print. It's actually 10 print CHR string 205.5 plus a random 1, go to 10. skipping some of the punctuation there, but it's the it's a book basically about the title, the program in the title, which sort of prints a random character in Commodore 64 BASIC that winds up making sort of like a maze on the screen. It kind of just sort of goes, what does it say? It takes a single line of code and uses it as a lens through which to consider the phenomenon of creative computing and how programs exist in culture and so forth. It's by Nick Montfort and a bunch of other people. And it's not a new book. I think this was 2012, but it is officially available as a like Creative Commons licensed PDF. So I of course forgot this just like seriously 3 weeks ago or something. I bought this on Amazon, but oh well. Anyway, hopefully you know my purchase price went to somebody useful, but nevertheless, it is available for free. Have either of you read this?
I have not. I have downloaded it, I'm pretty sure. I think I downloaded it a long time ago, and I have not ever actually read it.
It's on my list.
In fact, I think I even have it in iBook, so it must be on my phone and everything, but it's not something I've read.
Yeah.
One of these days.
It seems really interesting. I like the concept of it. It's quite sad that nobody seems to actually have managed to get to read it. But,
right.
But it was recommended to us by Mikai, so and also, you know, to just sort of remind us that it is available.
Yep.
This way. So, okay. So Blake on Twitter asked us if we knew about this, and I actually have no idea how to pronounce this, but perhaps CODEM, which is QODEM, which is a QModem emulator program. And there was he pointed out a video which I failed to retain the link for, but which was sort of like a review of the QODEM program. But it's essentially a public domain reimplementation of the DOS QModem serial communications package. So I think it basically just does all the same stuff that QModem did. You can use it to, I mean, you can actually use it to call also internet BBSs and stuff.
Excellent. No, I haven't seen this or used it, but might in the very near future, actually. I've got my PS2 Model 30 set up again, and the serial link is connected up to the PDP, and, you know, I was looking for some cool way to connect them up. There's a lot of choices, but this would be fun to try. I'm going to do it. Thanks, Blake. I didn't know about it, but now I do.
Uh-huh. Did you use QModem in the... back in the olden days?
Indeed, I did.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of my favorite terminal programs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was looking at it, and I don't think, particularly the, you know, I looked at pictures of the splash screen, and it doesn't look familiar to me. So I think I was a Procom person.
Oh,
not a
yes.
QModem person.
That's right. That was the other camp. Forgot about that.
I loved Procom. But I'm sure QModem's good too. So, and actually, so in that same video that Blake linked to, I feel like extra bad now that I've mentioned it twice that I didn't remember what to put the link in. I'll put the link in the show notes before anyone who's listening to this hears this. But there was also the video sort of showed using this QModem program using Cool Retro Term, which is a terminal program.
This thing is so neat. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I use that extensively. You know, there's a program like this for Mac OS X, and I can't honestly remember the name of it off the top of my head, and I apologize for that, because it's a really neat package that does essentially this. But this Cool Retro Term has all these knobs and dials that you can tune in to make your new crisp computer look like an old fuzzy CRT computer in really neat ways.
Yeah, it is quite cool. I've installed it and played around with it, and it can do a couple of different types of things. I think the one I liked the best ultimately was a relatively sharp IBM 3278. I think it was that was trying to emulate, but looked pretty cool. I think it's possible that the Mac app that you were thinking of, Earl, was a Cathode.
That's the one. Yes, I kept thinking console, a CRT. No, Cathode. That's the one.
I have that. I have bought that too, and it's cool. I actually should use them more than I do. I don't really use it in real life. I just use Terminal, but I think there was a time when I built one of the replica one Apple One kit things, and was when I was communicating with that, I used Cathode just because it seemed like it seemed appropriate.
And my wife totally didn't get it.
Well, I just grabbed the one we're talking about here, the cool retro term for Mac, and fired it up, and it's pretty amazing. It's pretty crazy. Like, it gives you all these. You can select Apple II, and you can hit full screen on this. Just like it, full screen's like any other Mac app, and there you go.
That's when I started it up, it was in like 40 column mode or something though. So it's like,
yeah.
I mean, like my prompt takes up the entire line practically. But
yeah, anyway, my wife was looking at it. She's going, well, it looks old. Why do you want to make your new computer look old? I'm like, because it's really cool. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Although I do believe that we have progressed. Like, the future is better than the past in certain respects.
Yes, definitely.
But, let's see. So one other thing is Tony wrote in. Yeah, these are all links. These are items of interest and news sent in by listeners. But anyway, so Tony pointed to a kind of interesting article, motherboard article, that says this in-browser Winamp emulator will take you back to 1999. That's basically, I've just told you what it is. It's a browser emulated version of Winamp, which is something that I know was huge. Since I lived on the Mac platform, I only kind of saw it peripherally, but I know that it was a big deal as far as like music playing went on the Windows machines.
Yeah, I'm in kind of the same boat. I'm aware of this, but I was not using Windows at all when this was current. Just like, nope.
Oh my goodness, Winamp was totally my ride when it came to music listening. I liked it because it was a good music player, but also it had direct inbuilt functionality for a lot of streaming services for various internet radio stations that played music or talk, or some people had their scanners linked, so police, fire, medical, that kind of thing. And so you could click all these stations right from within Winamp. So, yeah, it was pretty neat.
I think one of the things I knew about it was that it was also super skinnable, too. You know, there was this industry of making Winamp skins.
Yep.
The one that I used at the time that was kind of similar on the Mac was Audion by Panic. I loved that thing. That was a great music player. I think it did something that was sort of similar to Winamp, and that it used some kind of alpha channel so that it wasn't square. Like it was very skinnable and could be sort of partly transparent. So, you know, you could have this sort of like weird circle shaped thing that you could drag around the screen and things. But
ooh, cool.
And it sounded very good. But yeah, so Audion was I'll put a link in the show notes to the Audion story, which is basically talking about how Audion almost became iTunes. But essentially, Panic kind of like didn't go along with the offer from Apple, and then Apple bought the competitor. So, and then I didn't look at this last one. We got a link to a YouTube video that I sort of skimmed. But it's we'll put it in the show notes, whatever. Hopefully it's not too terrible. But but what it seems to be is sort of a review of a 1980s era cell phone from Radio Shack. So it's reviewing it as if it were sort of a current product, I think, although made now. And I think you may actually be using it. Is that possible? But it's one of these things. It's from what I can tell, it's like a suitcase practically that you carry around.
Yeah, the review looks humorous anyway. So,
yeah, hopefully humorous with some content. It looked to me like they were sort of serious about it and not just, can you believe how terrible life used to be?
Yep. Cool.
Take a look at that. I think that's all the links from listeners. So now we can turn to links we found ourselves. So Earl, you have the first one.
I do. Well, I really like the Retro Man Cave channel on YouTube. And in one of his latest videos, he looks at the GBS 8220, which is one of these video converters that goes from things like CGA, EGA, S-Video, that kind of thing, to VGA. And he shows this in use with an Amiga. And this is a pretty inexpensive board. I guess it's about $20. You can find these, and then you wire it up and you set a resolution on the VGA screen. I've seen typically the recommendation is to use these upscalers with, I don't technically know it's an upscaler. It's kind of doing that, though. It's taking these older signals and turning it into VGA. So whatever you call it, it works, and it's not perfect. There's some artifacting, and as you can imagine, anytime you're going from less resolution to more resolution, it's kind of like blowing up a photograph. You're going to see a little bit of graininess or some distortion based on this, but it looked pretty good. And for $20, you buy it, you wire it up, feed it 5 volts, and then you've got your Amiga working on VGA. And you can use it for more than Amigas. You can use it for a variety of things, like I was mentioning. And I think that Retro Man Cave is going to have a subsequent video on other uses for this board. But I've seen these all over the place, and I wanted to see some sort of a review of how it actually worked, because I've got a few machines that could benefit from this. And I guess the catalyst was that his monitor broke, and pretty neat monitor that had a lot of different kinds of inputs, RGB, composite, that kind of thing. And the monitor will maybe need repair at some point, but he was thinking these things aren't going to last forever. We've talked about this a lot of times on the podcast. And so What am I going to do? And this is what he did. And it was a neat, around, I think, 15-minute video. So we'll have a link for it up in the show notes, and you can see what some things look like. I found some of the things that he was showing. They're very interesting, like what the artifacting will look like on a busy screen versus what the artifacting looks like when you've got just a sea of one color. And ironically, you see it more in a flat screen of one color than you do on an image that has a lot going on. Also, if you put your face right up to the monitor, if you're looking at a magnified version, you're going to see the artifacting more clearly, whereas if you're sitting back at normal distance from a monitor, it's going to look pretty good. And he kind of compares it to, on one hand, one part of the spectrum, what it would look like if you were just showing it on an old TV versus what does it look like on a super cool monitor designed for this purpose. And it turns out it's kind of somewhere in between. So, so take a look at the video, and I'll stop talking now so that I don't actually go longer than the video is itself. But I really enjoyed it.
This looks really cool. I just kind of clicked through it a bit and looked at spots, and like one of the weaknesses of the Amiga, or one of its strengths and weaknesses, was it was tied to a standard video signal. Mm-hmm. So that meant that the same monitor that I had for my Amiga, I could also plug in a VCR. And it, you know, it was the same technology. But the downside was if you wanted to do high resolution, you had interlacing, and this just takes the interlacing away. Just like, it seems to just sort of, well, at least what I saw, it gives you a nice, stable, high-res image instead of what you had back in the day.
It did. It magically erased the interlacing. And I guess my speculation would be that since it is doing some processing in between taking the input and pushing it out on the output, that it's just taking the interlaced frames and generating a single composite VGA frame that it's pushing. Right. So you get a more beautiful picture. Yeah.
Yep. Very cool.
I'm always a little bit surprised at compact flash storage options have become rampant on every platform, every retro platform, but the video is always kind of like a little bit of a question. because maybe this might even be easier with an Amiga, in that it's probably got a kind of a standard sort of video out that even though it needs to be converted, but, I operate often in the Apple II world, and, the Apple II got color by just fooling with the NTSC signal. So like, right. it isn't quite actually NTSC compliant, which worked fine on an old TV that didn't care. But, it becomes harder and harder to try to find something that can run at, whatever it is, 15 frames a second and can handle these sort of like not quite on spec signals.
I guess that's why those Night Owl monitors were kind of popular, right, in the Apple II community, because for some reason they were able to deal with that just a little bit off NTSC signal.
Right, right. I was also thinking that we sort of missed the ability to just sort of like plug this into our big TV and see the sort of like the fuzzy thing. But I wonder if you can combine something like this, on a big fancy, whatever 4K TV with the retro terminals that we were just talking about. so that it actually really does a fair amount of real processing to give it curvature and occasional static and things.
That would be cool. A little post-processing unit that just has like HDMI in and out and is a tweakable like retro, like it would give you some like, some burn-in effect and
right. Yeah.
Weird rolling and curvature and
it has a little speaker that emits a high-pitched noise. Yeah, pretty cool. That'd be pretty excellent. I think that the trick with even fairly simple stuff like that is the lag. I mean, like, you notice it pretty quickly if there's any kind of delay.
Right.
So, but I don't know. You'd think our computers should be capable of doing that.
Well, they can. And if you want to get crazy about that kind of thing, in the FPGA world, there are boards designed exactly for this sort of real-time video processing. They implement a lot of the algorithms in hardware, and they're not terribly expensive. I mean, $200, $300, that's not chump change, but that's also not a rich fortune. And there's some really neat kind of real-time video processing that you can do with these. One of the ones I'm thinking about in particular is called the Zeebo board. It's got HDMI in and HDMI out, just like what Jack was talking about, and lots of fun video algorithms that you can use to make changes to the signal as it traverses the pipeline. So you could do that retro kind of stuff. That would be fun.
Yeah, cool. It's sort of comical though, in a way. Like your wall-sized 4K TV, you're trying to make it behave just like, whatever,
like an old Magnavox.
RCA. Right.
But I think there's a use for it, because I've seen, so at the place I'm working right now, there are guys who've brought in like an old Super Nintendo, or it's actually a Super Nintendo, this little mini thing. I don't know if it's in an emulator exactly or what it is, but, and they have that plugged straight in from through HDMI to a big 60-inch TV or whatever. And so every pixel on the original display is one big square pixel, right? Which
right. With sharp
on
edges.
Real TV, it never looked like that because everything was fuzzy. There's a certain amount of fuzziness in a CRT. So things that were a bit smooth are just very extremely jagged.
Uh-huh.
And like if you could do a little sort of finesse on that to make it a little bit softer, it would be more like what we had back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, even nostalgia aside, they were designed to look good on a fuzzy screen.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The Apple II emulator I kind of mainly use has one of those kind of retro screens on it. So I'm used to looking at it as if I was looking at an old screen. But when I use the other one, it is pretty off-putting to have everything just be so sharp like that.
Right.
It's interesting, cool. too, that this static that you can see on, on the retro term thing, because you don't see static anymore. There's going to be the next generation of kids growing up are not going to know what that is.
Right.
It didn't turn blue. I don't know what happened. I don't understand.
Yeah, like digital video signals have been a completely different disruption pattern, right? You know, you see right. things get pixelated or blocky or weird, but like never static.
Right.
That's true. You see MPEG clouds, you know, those kind of like on a scene that's completely dark. It's not completely dark because you've got some of the MPEG clouding, but you're right. You don't see the poltergeist, you know, thing that you saw in the movie where the monsters are in the static. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah. Though I suppose maybe I wonder if that also means that it won't be as the poltergeist is going to the movie Poltergeist will lose its scariness.
Like, what is that?
It's just too foreign. All right. Anyway.
By the way, is analog TV still broadcast in the U.S.? I'm out of loop here.
I don't think so. I think that analog TV powered down here quite a while ago. And I don't know if there's any pockets where analog TV or exceptions where it still exists, but overall, there was a cutoff date, and the transmitters went to digital.
Yeah. Because I know that happened here in Sweden, but I haven't really followed the U.S. What's happened?
I actually watched TV. I jerry-rigged myself a pair of rabbit ears so that I could see when the digital TV cutover occurred. They were saying, well, and now we're saying goodbye to analog TV in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boom. And it was toast.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if it's a good idea, but.
TV will come back after the apocalypse. So.
Right.
I mean, the thing is that, like, it's not like you could. TV already was complicated enough that you needed an analog TV receiver to get an analog TV signal. It's not. It's just that there were a lot of them around. And they all became useless. I sort of think that like analog radio is a little different. Like you could possibly cobble together something to receive an analog radio signal, but you can't do that and receive a video.
That's true.
Yeah.
So perhaps it's not as terrible as it seems, but it seems terrible somehow. all right. Anyway, yeah. Jack, you can tell us about Atari and cryptocurrency.
Yeah, so Atari, the company that we all love to wonder about what they're doing now, because it's so weird all the time. So they've announced they're jumping on the cryptocurrency bandwagon. And the last thing I think that we were hearing from Atari is they were talking about their new video game console. It's come out sometime this year, the Atari Box, which I guess is still happening, but they've decided instead to focus on cryptocurrency. They're going to have their own cryptocurrencies. Two of them is what I read. One called Atari Token, one called Pong Token. And they're going to be used for gaming, for digital entertainment services. I think one of these is going to be for online, like, video gaming, and one is going to be for gambling. So they purchased a stake in some company called Infinity Networks, which I don't know what it is, but it's one of these Malta companies. Which, like in Europe, a lot of the companies that do gambling stuff are actually technically situated in Malta. They can have employees wherever, but Malta is where it's apparently free to run gambling companies. And I don't know, I feel like, you know, it's so weird to see this company that's just like grasping at one straw after another. Because before the Atari Box, what was the thing that, the last thing I think I talked about was the Atari speaker hat. Which was a baseball cap with a speaker in it. I don't know. just so weird. It's like, I don't know what they're doing.
You know, the same sort of thing has happened with the Commodore brand over the years, that there have been everything from PET smartphones to set-top boxes to, you know, just various, what would I say, various sacrilege of the chicken head icon over time. So, yeah, kind of sad. But, I mean, at least the cryptocurrency world now is stable and mature. So I guess that's a good thing.
Right.
Sure. Yeah. What could go wrong?
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll put some links in the show notes for anyone who wants to look at this. I don't know what to think of it, frankly. I haven't really used cryptocurrency at all. I've had friends talking about it for years, and just to me, it's just been, I don't know. Like, I know that Bitcoin is worth a lot now. A lot more than it was 3 or 4 years ago. And I never bought any, so it doesn't help me anything. I don't really know. Uh-huh. And people talk a lot about Ethereum. There's a lot of interesting things that people are talking about, but I have not used any of it or putting it into it, any of it into practice for myself.
Well, yeah, it feels a little unreal in a way. Like, you know, I don't think that I would ever want to just have a lot of cryptocurrency that I hold on to. I mean, like, it seems like
right. All
it's good for is, you know, buying low, selling high, getting out.
Yeah.
But
if it's only for speculating, I'd rather speculate with something that I understand what it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
I favor, you know, I might be old fashioned, but I favor a tangible quantity as well of some sort. Mm. Even if it's a business investment, you know, this is just air. This is ones and zeros. So it's no wonder that the value has been so dynamic over time. I guess it's based on a pretty solid premise. I don't understand the mathematics of blockchain technology, but I understand that it does provide pretty high levels of assurance for auditing changes and
right. Very
difficult to forge, if not impossible, with today's technology to forge. Mm-hmm. So some advantages there. And I know big companies are looking at it for various purposes. But in terms of cryptocurrency, all I can say is I wish I would have cranked out some Bitcoin in the early days with my GPUs if I had a time machine.
Yep.
So interesting, Atari's jumping into that. We'll see the Mount Fuji logo, I guess, on coins coming to a store near you.
I guess.
All right. All right. Let's see. So I have an update to mention about, I think it was two times ago we talked about Disky model. So the Open Disky, an open source Arduino based replica of the I don't even know what Disky stands for, but it's the Apollo computer console, right? And we mentioned at that point that there was going to be some connection with a Kickstarter. It was really sort of unclear. So before it was listed as an instructable, and it kind of went through the, you know, like how this was sort of put together. The Kickstarter is now there. There are 13 days to go as we're recording this, so there still should be some time on it. It had a $20,000 goal. It is currently at $76,000. So it easily made its, it's on its way to at least quadrupling its goal. So what this allows for is basically, it is a little bit like a pre-order site, like we were guessing. So there's a couple of things that you can get that are sort of short of the whole unit, but you can get these little, I don't know what they are exactly, the LED button lights. So if you get $10 or more, pledge gives you a keychain, and I think $25 or more gets you these little three segment display units, little LED things, and it goes up to, so you can get it as a kit, and there's a couple different stages you can get it at. You can get it as a kit where you provide your own stuff, just like they send you the PCBs. You can get it as a thing, a kit with all the stuff, but you still have to build it. And that, I think if you do this, then you can get the full kit for $410. So it's not cheap, but it has all the pieces that you need. And at the early bird level 500 will get you in a completely assembled and tested one. So, yeah. So you get to evaluate how much fun you would have building it, whether you would actually build it, how much your time is worth, and so forth. But it looks, they do look really nice. So definitely check out the Kickstarter to take a look at the display units and stuff that they have it in and what they look like when they're assembled. But yeah, no, it's a neat project. So I still don't actually believe that I would really use it if I had it, but it would be cool.
I think it would be a conversation piece. And yeah. I could easily see something like this in an executive's office or something like that of a high-tech firm. They really do look nice. Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, they do seriously have an emulator inside of them. I mean, there's an Arduino Nano running right. The Disky. So it does work. If you ever wanted to actually use it, it would do what the original one did. Anyway, yeah, it's pretty cool. I was glad to see that it got as strong a level of interest as it did. I don't know that I'm going to get one, but it's still cool. Hmm. So, and Earl, you have the next Twitter observation here.
Yes. Well, I wanted to let people know that on Twitter, hashtag Plotter Twitter is a thing. And I mean, you guys are with me, right? That laser printers are a fad, and plotters are definitely making a comeback. Maybe not, but plotters are really cool. I love watching plotters. I used to have a plotter at home, a very obscure model. I can barely find any evidence that this machine ever existed, but Epson made one of these tabletop plotters called the High 80. And it was just fun to have it draw different designs and things like that. I loved it. And of course, there's the myriad of HP plotters that are, many of them are still out there and still working. It's not so much the plotter that's the issue, but the pens. But people are finding solutions for that. If you go to Twitter and you look up hashtag plotter Twitter, you're going to see a bunch of different people posting with either images of cool designs that they've made recently with their plotters or actual little short videos of the plotter in action. One thing that I had kind of forgotten over the decades, but these videos reminded me, plotters and the little servo mechanisms in there, or whatever the motors, make these cool sounds. It's almost like a medley, like a musical production when these things are plotting something. Especially if you get your ear right up close, or the microphone in the case of these videos. So I just love it. I showed one to my son. I actually, I'm feeling kind of bad. He's, naturally grown up with his weirdo dad with all this retro stuff, but has never seen a plotter in action, didn't even know what one was. And when he looked at it, he said, wow, that's like a 3D printer, but in 2D. I thought,
that sounds about right.
Nice
that's
observation.
Totally right. Yeah.
So we'll have a link up in the show notes. If you're not already on the Twitters, you can just click on this link and it'll take you straight to this search. And you can see what people are doing with plotters. And I'm loving it. It's more fun than a spirograph.
Definitely. Yeah, very cool. I also found in scanning through Plotter Twitter, I found that also there is a subreddit called Plotter Art. It's just full of people posting stuff.
Very nice.
Reddit is nice in its own. Like if you limit your focus to individual areas.
Right. Yeah, don't walk outside your neighborhood in Reddit. That's all I'm saying.
Excellent. Yeah. Jack, you have some more sort of Atari related news.
Yeah. So this is news more about old Atari instead of new Atari. So Nolan Bushnell, founder of Atari, back in January, GDC announced they're going to give him some sort of pioneer award for his pioneering work in the video game industry. And there was some backlash about this. This past fall has been the growth of this sort of hashtag Me Too. I don't know if we call it a movement, but societal reaction to a lot of bad stuff going on in various industries.
Mm-hmm.
And people saying, well, there are all these stories about you know, what went on at Atari and, you know, the thing with the company Hot Tub and the chips being named after secretaries who the engineers thought were attractive and that sort of thing. And to me, it kind of felt like, well, this team, you know, what they were saying, I get it. Like, Atari from the early 70s, a lot of what is described is stuff that today seems kind of sexist in some sense. And yet, I had never heard anyone talking about anything where actually accusing Nolan Bushnell of having done anything that would constitute any form of sexual harassment or certainly assault or anything like that. And I mean, I'm biased somewhat. I've met Nolan. I had a chance to hang out with him a few evenings and stuff, and he seems like a great guy. But, you know, again, this is, you know, many, many years later. Who knows what happened then? I was barely even born. But a couple weeks later, Kotaku published an article. They actually went out and tried to talk to a variety of female employees who worked at Atari in the early days. And the stories they came up with were pretty much the exact opposite. They were saying, yeah, there was a company Hot Tub, and it was, but that, in those days, that was sort of like, it was an interesting perk for a company, you know, a forward-thinking company. You know, nowadays you'll have ping pong at work or maybe a boxing ring. You know, tech companies are offering all sorts of interesting perks, and in those days, this was something that Atari was doing. And I read somewhere that they had like 2 days of the week were men only, 2 days were women only, and Fridays was mixed, whoever wanted to mix. But I also know from what listening to Kevin Savitz talk a lot is that he has tried to talk to various people who were at Atari and, so, you know, get them to dig up any sort of juicy stories. And everyone's like, no, I didn't really ever witness anything. You know, there were rumors, but, you know, so I don't know. I feel like it was kind of it was a reaction to something that maybe was not real. Or if it was real, like, I don't think that necessarily Nolan Bushnell was involved in any of it. So it's kind of, you know, I definitely want to say that I definitely support everything that the Me Too campaign has been doing in a general sense. And I think that there's a lot of things in the computing industry as well. There are a lot of things that need to, still today, there are companies that need to shape up and behave better. But I feel like it's kind of difficult to dig too far into the past and say, well, look, this thing, something that may or may not have happened 45 years ago, and when no one has actually been accused of anything, it's sort of, I don't know, it's kind of like guilt by association, but then no one's actually sure of, you know, who's associated with what that actually did anything wrong. But it was interesting, many of the women that they talked to in this Kotaku article, they said that, on the contrary, many of them reported that companies they went to after they'd been at Atari, they were disappointed at how unfair and unequal things were everywhere else. Like, they get used to being treated well at Atari, and suddenly they go to work somewhere else and find that, no, you will not be able to get to a higher position here because you're a woman, which is not what they had experienced there. So, anyway, I just kind of wanted to point it out. I have a link to the article at Kotaku. I don't know if you guys have come across either the original story or the follow-up here.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of vaguely aware of this, kind of at the periphery, that Bushnell was going to get an award and then wasn't, and you know, had a press release of some sort about this. Mm. I did not look into it too carefully. I mean, like, I think Bushnell probably had a particular, I mean, like, the thing that the trick with him, I think, is that he probably had the power to shape the environment a bit, you know. So whether he specifically, you know, sort of contributed to the environment being bad.
Right.
He may have, but also it would have been within his power to make it less bad.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't really know. I don't know the details of it. It's, I mean, it is tricky to think back at that time, because it was, I mean, you know, the norm back then was probably pretty terrible.
Right.
So I mean, like, even, you know, even if it was even worse outside of Atari, it was still, you know, probably pretty terrible even there, at least in certain places. And so, yeah, it's hard to evaluate how, like, people's behavior back then against a backdrop of like having to be alone and behaving differently if you were going to behave differently. That makes sense.
Sure. That's true. Yeah, so. I think, you know, one important distinction when people are looking at these things from a historical standpoint is it's true the culture was different and expectations were different. There's still a distinction to be made between behavior that's unwanted versus behavior that's just out of step with what you'd normally see in a company today. You know what I mean? I think that unwanted behavior was just inappropriate always. I don't think there was a time that it was ever okay, even if it was culturally a little bit more accepted than it is now. But outside of that, what I guess you would say consensual behavior, you know, well, that's culturally a lot different today than it was back then, too. It's also kind of interesting to dig up what happened, like you say, Jack, decades ago, because different people will have different recollections and perspectives about that kind of thing. And it would be easy. You know, I'm with you. I support this Me Too movement, the cultural phenomenon that's happening now. By the same token, it would be easy to accidentally impugn somebody for something that was perceived to have happened decades ago when maybe it didn't even happen. Like this subsequent article you're talking about in Kotaku seems to indicate that maybe people's perceptions were just colored by rumor and innuendo as opposed to actual accounts of behavior. So, man, it's just... And I feel like we're walking on landmines talking about this, by the way. But it is fascinating. And the rumors about Atari were pretty salacious. So it's interesting that we can't know, I guess, whether or not some of them were true or not.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I have to go by, the rumors were salacious. And then at the same time, again, I think about all the interviews where I heard Kevin talking to people at Atari who would say, yeah, I don't know, maybe, like, I don't know. Like, it seems like there was more innuendo than anything else. And in fact, I think this is something that Nolan actually stirred up a bit and has stirred up for a long time, talking about, you know, the party atmosphere and that sort of thing, which I think was, you know, it probably was very different from if you, you know, were working at 3M and you went to go work at Atari. I think it was a whole different ball game. But I think it was also, it was a company that was, you know, a different company to work for and kind of progressive in many ways. And also right on the cusp of a new sort of sexual liberation movement that was happening in the US. And I think that there were probably borders definitely being pushed in terms of what is appropriate to be happening in the workplace in general, whether that means that it's that anyone is actually being offended or harmed or harassed in some way is a separate issue. But like, you know, you could have people who are fully consensually getting naked in a hot tub. And today we would think if that happened, like at my workplace, I'd be like, This is, you know, totally crazy. This is not...
HR would descend from the rafters with
right. Like, even if everybody there wanted to be there, it'd be like, oh my God, this cannot happen. And there, it seems like that's something that maybe could have happened, and no one was yet, you know, I think it was so far forward that no one even thought about that it could happen and it could be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, and again, I think that it's the thing where... A lot of the Me Too movement, most of it has been built up of individuals coming out either anonymously or publicly saying, this happened to me. This person did this to me. You know, Harvey Weinstein did this to me. And I think that is kind of the standard we have to go after is if people are saying that somebody did something.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas I think a lot of the reaction I saw to the GDC initially announcing this award for Nolan was that people saying, well, it seems like maybe something could have happened to somebody. And it's a bit too much conjecture there. I don't know.
Maybe a bit too vague. On the other hand, companies are definitely going to err on the side of caution at the moment. Companies, organizations, that sort of thing right now, because everyone is so sensitive to the realities of what society has allowed to go on for too long. So people are definitely going to walk on the side of reducing their own either reputation or financial liability or that kind of thing.
Right.
So,
Also, the other thing, too, that occurred to me is that these, I believe, were all pretty young kids, essentially, like when this company started. I don't know about Nolan himself, I think, was not, right? But much of the rest of Atari was, really.
Yeah, I think a lot of people working there were in their early 20s, probably. So it's, you know.
So it's
and what I read is that, there were a lot of office romances and flings, consensual, you know, and maybe that maybe happened more than it had at other companies, but maybe that's just because so many of them were people who were 20, 22, you know.
Or on the other hand, maybe didn't happen more than what happened in other places, but was more publicized because of the public perception or, you know, of a party atmosphere there.
Yeah. Could be.
So, because, you know, with the tech companies in the 70s and 80s, you just in general had a lot of young people working for those companies, young, smart, you know, energetic, and so there you go.
All right.
Yep. Well, move us on. I think we've done great. Move us on before we step in something.
Right, exactly. all right, so the next thing, I have the next thing. So John Linville did a write-up for the Game Master cartridge, and the write-up is on Vintage is the New Old, that site. And so this is it's a cartridge for the color computer, the Coco. Essentially what it is a system extender of a sort. So it has, I think it expands the memory capability, and in particular expands the sound capability quite a bit. So it has a onboard TI SN76489 digital complex sound generator.
Well, that's got to be good. That's got lots of letters and numbers.
Exactly, and it ends in 9. So this heroic little chip can add to a game enjoyable music in 3-part harmony without requiring complex code and cycle counting and all that stuff. So, essentially what it is, it seems like, is just a system expander for the Coco, and the goal is basically to, like, write games for it, you know, like to write things that depend on this being there. So I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, I don't think this kind of thing didn't work even that well back when these were sold new, right? you know, like there were some things, you know, again, my Apple II Focus, I remember things like the Mockingboard we talked before about and things, you know, even that, you can't assume everybody had one. You know, and that was one of the big ones that people did have, this sound generating card. But I don't know. It's an interesting idea, though. So basically, it's a little thing that soups up your Coco to be able to make fancier 8-bit games.
Well, same problem now as back in the day, right? If a peripheral didn't have critical mass, then you wouldn't have enough support for it.
Yeah.
But I think this is actually a different beast here. My reading of this is that this is not something that you buy and then play games on, but rather this is built into a game. So if you're going to make a cartridge game for the Coco, you can add this technology to your cartridge. That's what I'm reading of this.
Ooh.
Okay. Yeah, I missed that. So the thing I was about to say, actually, that makes more sense in that context, I think. But so the rationale for making this was that there were cases, I feel like this was being discussed very recently, and I forget now where that was. Perhaps it was on this very podcast, but to overcome some of the stuff, some of the lack in the base computer. Yeah, it was the Atari, whatever it was, the third generation one.
Yeah, we're talking about the Atari 7800, and the some games have a built-in Pokey for better sound.
Yes. This is all coming back to me now.
Yep.
they were just pointing out, I guess, that a lot of, you know, like usually you don't have this good stuff available unless they actually stuck it in the cartridge. And so this was supposed to be kind of doing the same thing, although I had understood this to be something that you kind of you plug in and then plug in, you know, your homebrew software to make use of that. But so you're saying that this is actually a platform to build cartridges on?
That's what I'm seeing here. Okay. It talks about saying that you can build this, and if you're at current eBay prices, the GMC technology only adds about $3 to the cost of building a cartridge. So it seems that the notion seems to be that you're writing a game, you can write a game that will use this stuff. And of course, you'd have to have this board, I guess, during your development. But then when you're shipping the game, you ship a cartridge with this technology built into it. This is my understanding of it. I could be wrong, but it seems like that. So it even says, actually, for most folks, the only way to acquire GMC technology will be to buy a game cartridge with the technology built into it. So looking at like the second and third paragraph, it seems to suggest this.
Right. Seems so inefficient. If you have three games, you have three of these then.
Right.
Oh, well.
But if it only adds $3 to the cost, then it's not a... Cool.
Yep. Cool thing. I'm glad he wrote it up, and Jack, that you understood it. But all right. The last thing is another foray into the Twitter world. Earl, you have one other thing you wanted to mention.
Yeah, another thing I saw on Twitter. Stuart Chaffee, who was co-host of Computer Chronicles for all those years, fantastic gentleman. He's considering producing a play about his friend and co-host Gary Kildall. He's thinking about, according to the tweet, looking for either crowdfunding, something like a Kickstarter, or investors for the idea. And he posed the question on Twitter whether people would support this. And if you're on Twitter, I would say consider tweeting back to him with your thoughts. From my perspective, I think Gary Kildall has not had nearly the historical coverage that his legacy deserves. I would personally love to see this produced as a play. I thought, what an interesting idea of how to capture the life of Gary Kildall. And it never even, I mean, I don't know that I've ever heard of a stage play about any of the retro computing pioneers. So I thought that just seems pretty innovative. One of the people who replied to him on Twitter mentioned that they would love it if the stage play was also captured on video somehow. They could buy it on a DVD because, of course, wherever it played, you'd only have a limited subset of people that'd be able to get to it. But anyway, we'll have a link for this particular tweet up in the show notes, and if you're on Twitter, let Mr. Chaffee know your thoughts.
It'd be a really interesting thing to see this happen, and Stuart Chaffee himself would be probably a pretty good person to be able to do this. I mean, I think they knew each other well enough for him to sort of do this right.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, I guess that wraps up the news segment, and so now, a word from our sponsor.
Like humans, computers have memories. Unlike humans, their memories shrink when they work. Functions like color, sound, and movement use up large amounts of memory, leaving little for you to use. The new Auric Atmos, however, takes these functions in its stride, leaving lots of memory, so you can expand into advanced programming and sophisticated games. The new Auric Atmos 48K, the large memory that stays large.
And we're back. All right, so being the host, I am responsible for finding the retro computing gift idea. And the gift idea that I have for us this time is, it's on ThinkGeek, and it is Centipede Board Game, the exclusive Atari 2600 edition, because we have not talked enough about Atari this time. So here's some more Atari stuff. It appears to be officially licensed. Centipede board game. So it's for two players or four players, and one side represents the gnome looking to defeat the centipede. So apparently this is not something I knew before, but when you're playing centipede, you are a gnome.
I was not aware of that.
I don't know.
Unknown centipede lore.
I want my quarters back.
Yeah. So you roll dice, and you know, there's the little pieces. There's 7 gnome control cards and 12 centipede segments and 30 mushroom tokens and so forth and so on. It's pretty cool. It's in stock now at $16, so, which is on sale from like the normal price of $40. So, it has nice Atari looking box art and things. So, I think it's pretty cool actually.
The sale price is fantastic.
Yeah,
I've not played the game obviously, but it looks cool. I would love this.
It might be fun. I wonder if it's fun. There's a there's a Lode Runner game that I think was not fun.
Right.
But not everything makes the transition.
No.
Well.
Weird. Who would think?
Anyway, yeah, I am tempted actually.
Hmm.
But that's the good thing about buying something from a big company. There might well be more if I buy one. All right, so when you're done spending your money on that, you can turn to eBay and spend your money on what Earl tells you to do. So, Earl, what should they spend their money on?
Well, there's a really neat Commodore PET, and it's one of the ones that has the curvy industrial design on it. And I got to tell you, this eBay auction almost didn't make it past my normal eBay auction filters. First off, any words in capital letters normally get filtered out immediately, like look or rare. And This one has rare in capital letters, so that was strike one. And then anything that has a super high price gets filtered out almost immediately. But there's one caveat. If there's a make an offer, then I tend to be a little bit more forgiving on that because you can offer whatever you want and you still get down to let the market decide. But This Commodore PET, I think it's the 8296 model, It is in gorgeous shape. And it appears to be at least power on and type some stuff on the screen functional because the person in the photograph here typed a message to eBayers saying hello and kind of proving that the machine does at least wake up and appear to do something. These are a little bit more rare than your standard boxy PETs, and they are gorgeous to look at. I don't think it's worth the buy it now price, but I think if you wanted to make them a reasonable offer, that it could be worth it. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Interesting. Never seen it.
It is very pretty. It's weird. It actually, it sort of looks like it's made out of clay or something. But is this the one that wasn't actually designed by Porsche?
I believe that's correct. It was designed by another designer whose name escapes me, but the rumor was always that they were designed by Porsche, but were not, in fact. But it was a very accomplished designer, and you can tell that, you know, they're getting away from the 2001 Space Odyssey sort of squared off PETs to something that might look a little bit more pleasant in an office setting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Though they're weird still. They're very distinctive. I would kind of like to have one of these. But even the boxy PETs I feel are a little hard to come by. And I think I've probably only seen a handful of these round ones.
Still, I feel like $1,100 is a stretch on the buy it now. Don't think that I think that's too high, but I guess we'll see. Maybe I'll come back to this eBay auction in a little while and see what happened. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Jack.
No, it's fine. I was just going to say, I noticed on the back there's a sticker that shows 220 volts and 50 hertz. And made in West Germany and a little bit of something else in German. So I guess this is clearly a German model. Were these available in the U.S. market also? Or were these only European? Because I've never even seen these or heard of them.
I don't know that answer. I don't know whether or not they were ever available in the United States. I certainly never saw one in a computer store in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it seems like, you know, there were a variety of computer models from various manufacturers that didn't sell very well and then wound up in liquidation houses. You guys know what I mean? Like, wasn't Protecto one of those?
Did you just make that up?
No. That what were they called again? let me go ahead and Google this in real time. Was it Protecto Industries or something like that that had
did fire sales?
You know, DAC was another one that, you know, they'd gobble up a bunch of these things and then sell them at fire sale prices. So maybe there was something like that. I'd have to go dig it up.
I wish I had been paying attention at that point to buy them. But I really actually kind of like the way this keyboard comes away. You know, that it's got the connection. It's a sort of reminiscent of the keyboard on the SX64, I guess. That, you know, you can sort of, it can look like a pet and if you have it up against the actual machine, but it also comes away.
Yeah.
But okay, so we have I think it's like the last three shows running have had auctions from this same seller. This seller is in Nova Scotia and has a whole lot of really like quite impressive vintage computers that are being sold. So it seems like it's like an actual collection that is being liquidated in some way. So I've just seeing who it's from, you know, this is the seller's name is Sci-Fi-Man. That sort of got me past whatever hang up I might have with the big capital rare. I've come to trust that these are, well taken care of things, at least.
I see.
So, it's still very expensive.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to sell, this would be a seller that is probably worth watching in the near future, just for the other things that come up as well.
Interesting.
Oh, here we go. I'm looking on Wikipedia. It might not have been this 8296, but on Wikipedia, when they're talking about the B series of the CBMs, they said the B128 did not sell well, and ultimately Commodore's inventory was liquidated by Protecto Enterprises, a large Commodore mail order dealer based in Chicago. The Protecto ads for the B128 bundle, including a dual disk drive, monitor, and printer, appeared in various computer magazines for several years. So, yeah, it's one of those liquidation scenarios, but I don't know if it applies to this particular model or not.
All right. Yeah, I think I was reading Apple magazines at the time and never saw any of these.
So, no, I didn't just make up that name.
Yep. I assumed not, but... All right, Jack, you have something also 64
yes.
related.
I have something called the Oric Nova 64, which I had never heard of before I stumbled across it. This is some Eastern European computer, I think. So this is based off of something else called the Oric 1, I think, initially. I guess it was initially from an English company, and they licensed it to, licensed to Hungary or something. And this is it's a tiny thing, like form factor, think of like a Sinclair style computer, but it has real keys. And that's actually the only thing that it really caught my eye, because it's very nice looking. It's very sort of stark black with red keys for shift and control and arrows and stuff. I would not buy this, but I think it looks very cool.
This does look neat.
And so this is I think the computer this is based off of has its origins in the early 80s and is comparable to the early Sinclair models. And I think this model, the main difference is it has more RAM. It's a later edition. This thing comes with some sort of side box that I'm not sure. I guess it's maybe a cassette interface or something. I'm not really sure.
I couldn't tell if it was the power brick. Then that was pretty amazing, because the power brick's like bigger than the computer. But
yeah.
maybe it's not. Maybe it's something else.
So the thing, I'm looking at the box cover where you can actually sort of see a picture of that thing.
Yeah.
And it says micro disc on it.
Mm.
So that sounds interesting, doesn't it?
Micro disc.
Yes. Yeah.
In the description it says, computer starts properly, blah, blah. The floppy case is without the disk drive / controller. Was sold as is by the manufacturer. The case is used as the power supply. Seems weird.
Okay. So it's just pretending to be a a floppy.
It's a power supply in disguise, pretending to be a disk drive. Anyway, it's a cool looking thing. I like the tiny keyboard with real keys. This thing has currently no bids and is going to expire within a day of us talking about it. So maybe it'll be relisted before anybody hears this. But worth looking at. Different sort of thing. I've just never seen it before.
Yeah. If it does get relisted, usually I will put the relisted listing in the show notes.
Yeah.
So,
good.
I was aware of that. Like the Auric one is one of the things that I would not mind getting a hold of, but I haven't seen many options. There's someone on my Twitter feed that you know has lots of them, but
okay.
It's a 6502 based little Sinclair sized machine. Mm-hmm. So like I would know how to speak its language. Right. Which would be kind of cool. But I hadn't seen these other ones. There's an Auric Atmos, which looks a little bit like the 64 thing that you found.
Yeah, I think what I read was that the Auric Atmos was kind of an offshoot of the original Auric 1 with some improvements and a better keyboard, and that the Auric Nova 64 is an offshoot of that with additional RAM.
Okay.
And maybe something else.
Yeah. I would kind of like it, but I'm also there's also this kind of irrational part of me that I kind of want it because it sounds like Orac from Blake 7. I don't know if this means anything to anybody, but somebody out there is going to know what I'm talking about.
All principal circuits are operating at full capacity and cannot receive new programs at this time.
Okay, I will move on to my little pile. The first one I have is a TI-99/4A sealed editor assembler. I thought this was kind of cool and not too expensive. It's $38 buy it now. And it's always kind of neat to see things that have survived, so this made it all the way to 2018 without having been opened. It's basically a sort of soft folder. And inside of it, there would be, I assume a cartridge. I don't know if there'd be a cartridge it mentions it having a disk drive. So I don't know if it had a disk option or a disk requirement, but anyway, if you wanted to, if you really wanted to do your assembly programming on a TI-99/4A, this might be for you. But it's in great condition. It's not very expensive. All right. The next one actually was sent in as a bit of listener feedback by Andrew. This is a K-Pro 4 in Australia. And I think the K-Pro 4 is kind of available on eBay, but I think the in Australia part is the part that makes this most unusual, at least according to Andrew. So they're pretty. They're actually kind of nice looking machines. They're sort of like black and gray and fairly stylish. Big screen. This particular one, you can see it. It does power up and the screen works. I don't know if it gets any further than that. I have a K-Pro that does exactly that. It says, please insert your disk, and no matter what you do with the disk drive, it never gets past that screen.
Oops.
But I do have a replacement disk drive I'm going to put in my K-Pro 2 at some point.
I had a K-Pro 2 with the exact same problem. It seems like the disk drives in those just weren't all that happy. I'd replaced one or both of the drives with some half heights, which didn't fit correctly in the form factor. So it looked weird, but it worked. But that didn't make me happy, so I sold it. It seems like those drives in the K-Pros are a common point of failure.
Huh. Okay, well, I don't know if that's makes me optimistic or not, but I will still try it. Honestly, that plan of mine to try this is probably, 2018? It's like 5 years ago or something that I that I bought the extra disk drive to put in there. So what am I doing? I don't understand. But anyway, but this K-Pro 4 looks nice. Anyway, so if you're in Australia, it's being auctioned. So right now it's at about $148 Australian. I have no idea what the shipping would cost, but because it wouldn't ship to me. The next one that I came across, I don't know what to think about this. In fact, I started half looking it up, and then I didn't finish it. But the title says Vintage AT&T Scepter Computer, and it shows you know, something that looks like an old computer of some sort. It has a keyboard, a little sort of chiclet type keyboard with apparently little rubber keys on it. It has a box that says with clearly little lights say data, phone, power. I didn't know what this was. I looked it up, and it's apparently this was a machine that was used for the two largest deployments of video techs in the United States, Knight Ridder's Viewtron service in Florida and Los Angeles Times Gateway service in Southern California. So it was used for, like, you know, news communication. It is a set-top unit, 1983, so it is actually, like, from the olden days. It had a modem that you could use to connect. And it looks kind of interesting. It's basically a dedicated terminal. Oh, and I think you hook it up to a TV for the display.
And it's one of the ugliest things I've ever seen. I would put it in my top five ugliest retro computing devices. AT&T, you couldn't do any better than this? Wow.
And the keyboard is wireless, too, actually. It's like infrared or something. So if you sit just a little bit too far off to the side... It's a weird thing that I'd never seen before. Anyway, I wouldn't recommend necessarily buying it, but it's a weird thing that I hadn't seen before.
I got that. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, like I saw it has on the back, it has ports for phone line, external phone, and some other external thing. And then it has in from VHF antenna and VHF out to TV.
Uh-huh. Oh, so you can sort of daisy chain this in.
Since it has an input, I wonder if it actually can do things like overlay its output on top of a screen. So, like, say you could be watching the news and have your text feed, you know, running in front of it or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, $228 and you can find out.
Not going to do it.
Nope. Right. I mean, it does actually look...
Or make offer.
Oh, true.
Make That's offer.
True. Mm-hmm. This particular one, as I say, like, I haven't come across them, so I don't have many to compare it with, but it's clearly cracked, you know, so it's not in perfect condition. My impression is that it's largely a dumb terminal. So that's actually possibly good if it means that you can use it without necessarily some service that is long dead needing to be on the other end. But, okay, so the next thing I have is... Okay, it says Apple IIgs model A2S6000 prototype rare parts for parts or repair. And, you know, this is one of those auction titles that would cause Earl to immediately close it. But, and I looked at that and I thought, all right, I will, I'll click it open so that I can mock this, you know, like this person who believes they have a prototype. But in fact, actually, it's sort of interesting. I don't even know quite what to make of this. So I thought I would talk about it. Maybe I can figure it out as I talk. But it is, in fact, it's fairly standard 2GS, and inside it does have, in the ROM slots, it has two, I think they're both EEPROMs, at least one of them is, that are labeled with, you know, specific Apple part numbers, 341-0749 and 1-341-0728 on the other. And, you know, doing a little bit of research, it does seem that those are the part numbers for, it was like a leaked beta release or something for the ROM 3 GS. So it leaked in some sense. I'm not exactly sure. Like, some got out, but then they found bugs. And so they quickly changed over to, you know, like a replacement set. And I think these really are not common out in the world. So the thing is that, so what you would get with this is you would get an uncommon buggy ROM, you know, if that's what you want. Then, it would be tempting to get this if it were, except that I think that they're already documented, you know, like I think it is known what's on those ROMs, so, and what they fixed and that sort of thing. So, but it is still interesting. The title of the auction is almost dramatic enough to make it seem fake, but but there's something to it. So anyway, I thought that was
interesting.
Kind of interesting. One thing that I do credit the seller for is the not deciding to say, all right, you can buy it now for $12,000. It is a buy it now for $155,000, which is, it's like maybe like twice what you might expect to pay for a working GS. Maybe not even twice. So it's not a crazy price. But I'm not sure if you want a buggy ROM.
Right.
Let's see. So two more to go. The penultimate one is, I don't know what I think about this. So maybe this is almost a conversation topic, but this is a vintage lot of NASA, Army, McDonnell Aircraft, Sperry, Rand, UNIVAC original documents. Essentially, the description says, comes from an estate of a retired Sperry Rand engineer and is a large lot of original documents, reports, confidential papers, and handwritten notes from McDonnell Aircraft, NASA, and the Army. Should this be on eBay? First of all, I wonder. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I suppose secrets from the 60s aren't secrets anymore, but anyway, it's kind of interesting to look at them, you know. So it's, you know, someone who worked with UNIVAC and has some documents relating to it and to some of these other other things. You know, it doesn't look like it's super. Like, it looks sort of historical. I'm not sure I would understand even how to deal with it. But there's there's some documentation on the UNIVAC 1004 card processor, and there's these little like error report sheets and things like that. And you know, it's all written like it was printed in the 60s or 58, I guess. So they're kind of cool. I kind of don't want them to just go to some random eBay seller or buyer, I mean. But anyway, it's worth taking a look at them. I sort of feel like I don't have enough of a connection to them to bid on them. But here's one that's a reliability report for the Titan guidance computer.
I really love the designs in some of these, like the one you mentioned, the Titan guidance computer, where there's clearly like a design of like a rocket ship thing across yeah. the top. And it's this interesting two color print job where there's some grid lines and the rocket outline are in red. And then there's numbers around, you know, labels for what the grids indicate are in black. I like in general, they have a lot of these have an interesting use of color, like this two color print that they've done red and black or red and blue. It's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Like, they went to a lot of effort to make their sort of, like, blank sheets of paper that people are going to write in stuff look kind of nice. Like, the one that's, like, it's a bug report sheet.
Yeah.
And it says, zero defects across the top in a kind of a weird all-caps font. And it has things you would fill in, like, what the bug is. Like, error caused removal request. And it says, I so-and-so, department something-something. Request this change in the description, and my suggestion to restore the error to fix the error is this. But then up near the top, it has like a print that's in like a cursive font. It says, "It's up to you!" Exclamation point! Like, it's up to you to make sure we have no defects. And yeah. also on the sheet, like there's a diagonal all caps that just says another bug. Like, it's like, here we go. It's another one.
It's a,
like, to get you excited about filing a defect report.
I can tell you, I worked in aerospace in the 80s, and there was still some of that going around. Let's get you excited about a memo. We even had acronyms for what the memos were called. So this is very believable.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of charming.
Yeah.
But... So it's neat to look at the pictures, even if you don't get it. But it really looks, you know, now that I see that some of the dates are 1958, that seems just spot on.
Mm-hmm.
This is what 1958 looked like, at least from what I know. I can't say I was around, but everything I've seen from about then looks like this.
This eBay auction almost looks like somebody opened up a drawer in this dark section of the building. You know, that people hadn't been to since the 50s. And they were like, look, a drawer full of file folders. Let's sell it on eBay. And It looks like a time capsule. Kind of tough to know, though, when you do they talk about how many pages of stuff that it is? Because it's tough to know how much you'd be getting with this auction.
My assumption is that the first photo is really an overview of all of it, you know, so that it's not actually that much. I mean, there's some mm-hmm. packets with like paper clips and stuff, probably well rusted paper clips, actually. It's not completely clear what's behind them and how tall the stacks are and things, but I think it's the contents of a small box, you know, not like a lot, though. I mean, you know, well, okay. So they're asking. I mean, the starting bid on this is $73. They're not kidding around on this, and it's quite possible that there are other boxes. There will be more. That's hard to know. Yeah, and I don't imagine this was cleared with anybody. You know, hopefully there aren't any like remaining secrets hiding in here. But anyway, pretty cool.
Neat.
And then the last one was just. Possibly not. Well, okay, so another sort of discussion topic, I suppose, but these are boxes of 3M tapes. It says 3M Black Watch computer tape, 2,400 feet in tape seals. I don't know what seals mean. 10 reels, though. So what they're selling are packs, you know, a box of 10 of these 2,400 foot tape reels for $28 in shipping. That sounds super cheap to me. Honestly. And then, so I thought, you know, I think that's kind of cool. And then at the same time, I think, what could I possibly use these for? I mean, they're only decorative. Like, I'm never going to have a tape machine.
No.
Well, you know, the surprising thing to me was that there are, if you ever wanted to, that there are some smaller form factor real tape machines that can be had on eBay that attach up to like a parallel port or something like that. And are auto loading, like you slap in the tape and it automatically sucks it up and starts to, I'm not sure what it would practically be useful for, but the other thing I would be wondering about would be the date of manufacture for these reels. Because don't these suffer from the same sort of things as floppy disk and cassette tapes that your oxide's going to start to flake off after a while?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. These look pretty new, actually. I mean, new maybe like the 90s.
right.
But
which is probably new enough in that case. But.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm kind of conflicted about this because I feel like I've seen these around. Like, I think we had a couple of these around the house, you know, occasionally, because these kinds of things were used by computers at where my mother worked, you know. And so there's a certain, and I suspect that anyone who worked with these, like IBM mainframes and that kind of stuff, would have a little bit of a nostalgic twinge, you know, seeing these. Mm. I'm tempted to buy them. They're kind of cheap. It would look kind of neat. But I also feel sort of bad for anyone who actually needs them, you know, who has a tape machine and they're all bought by people who just want to like display them on their wall. So I don't know. Hence the conflict.
Yeah, it's tricky. Like if someone actually wants this and actually has a need for it, like you said, it actually is a good price.
Yeah. So.
Assuming that they actually work, which they might.
Yeah, I mean, they appear to be basically just new boxes that they found. Okay, so I've made it through all of the things I had put down. So we can move to closing discussions. And Earl, you have written something here. Explain.
Yeah, what I wrote was Cubus Frankenstein, just enough to remind myself that when I got my PDP-11 from a local person in Portland, it was one of these rescue situations where I got just a ton of stuff. I mean, basically, I got enough in terms of the computer brains itself to build three PDP-11 systems with a CPU and RAM and controllers and that. Didn't get enough disk drives to do all that, but on one of the chassis, the power supply was busted, but otherwise it's in working order. And I know that people have gone out to eBay or other places and gotten switching power supplies for the 5 and 12 volts that you need for these. And I've just been thinking, I like my little small refrigerator-sized PDP-11, but it is awful noisy to power it up. And I can't guarantee that the ginormous disk drives are going to last forever. And I thought it'd be fun to make just a little Frankenstein with the card cage, get some switching power supplies, get... there are various solutions for a tape drive emulator for the PDP-11, something that emulates the old TU-58 tape drives, which were actually not just a purely sequential device, but were a random access device. They'd fast forward and rewind as needed. And since when you're using an emulator, it doesn't have to physically fast forward a tape, it's only pretending, they can actually be pretty speedy. So you can boot a PDP-11 with one of the tape drive emulators and have a running system that's not quite as fast as if you had a disk drive, but it's usable. So I'm thinking about finally pulling the trigger on this and starting to build my little Frankenstein PDP-11, which will be small and light, and maybe I'll build even a little acrylic case for it, and it won't have to weigh 500 pounds to use it.
That sounds like you can bring it with you on business trips.
Exactly. My portable PDP-11, yes. Not to business trips, but if there's like local club meetings or something like a VCF or little things like that, if you could have something that you could actually put under your arm and take with you. I have taken a PDP-11 card chassis and a tape drive emulator to a club meeting before, and it's stinking heavy. Because it's not just the card cage. I mean, DEC made these things out of whatever's the heaviest metal on earth is what they made these out of, I'm sure. It's kind of like old Sun equipment or old SGI equipment. It don't drop it on your foot. But if I replaced it with switching power supplies and some lighter fans and maybe instead of this super metal, maybe some sort of a lighter weight case, then yeah, it's something you could take with you and show off and run programs on and that. It's not that the circuitry is that much heavier than standard PC of the same era. It's just the chassis are super lead weighted. Mm-hmm. So that's my thought. I might get started on that project this week. I've been putting it off for a while. And I might actually get out the screwdriver and start doing some stuff.
Cool. If you do, you should take some pictures, some before and after. We can see what you're doing.
That would be a great idea. Yeah, or maybe a little bit of video or something like that. Yeah. And slap it up on the tube.
Yeah.
Take pictures of your foot before.
This is my foot before I dropped a PDP-11 on it.
Yeah, speaking of the portability, it reminded me, and I went and quickly Wikipedia searched, but there was a Soviet home computer called the Electronica that was a PDP-11 architecture.
I would love to have one of those, by the way. I've read about those.
Yeah. It would be pretty cool to see. They've shown up occasionally on, these eBay segments. There's but of course they're not cheap and they have to be shipped from somewhere, over an ocean.
Right.
It would be, and actually the other thing too is I wouldn't even have the first idea how to begin to use it, but it's a cool, it's a neat thing just because it does sort of feel like a PDP shouldn't fit in, something that's the size of a, Commodore 64. Jack, did you have any things you wanted to mention?
Nope, not really.
All right.
I'm good.
What about you, Paul?
I have, just miscellaneous things have been going on. So one thing that's, just quite recently I did was scanned. I had at Kansas Fest, Steve Wyrick gave me a couple of sort of magazines that he had accumulated over the years that were basically like UK-based Apple II magazines. And so one of them is called Windfall. And I'd never heard of this before, before he handed them to me. So I finally got around to scanning a couple of those and posted those, but that's been kind of interesting. It's always kind of interesting to see what was going on in Europe, in this same area that I was interested in, because it's all new Like, all these articles are articles I've never read before and wouldn't have had access to before. Interesting, you know, sort of ads for things and stuff like that. So another thing that I got, which was pretty pretty weird, you know, it might well, I may well have come across this as I was, you know, searching for, you know, stuff for last week's eBay things. But I have this box that's by Milton Bradley, you know, so like, you know, regular sort of like game maker. It's a box called Programming, Animation, and Graphics Task Cards. And they're basically little cards that are kind of like teaching you to program an Apple II. And it's, they do sort of seem like the kind of thing you would give to kids in school, you know, that you kind of work your way through the cards. But they're weird. I mean, like, so there's a bunch of different types, you know, so there's task cards, and then there's sort of like descriptions, there are definitions of basic commands and things, and there are teacher notes. So that's the thing, is you can't just give a student a deck of these, because, I mean, like, you know, some proportion of them are, they're, you know, the cards are for the teachers. So I don't know. I don't actually understand who the audience is exactly, but or how this was supposed to work. But I suppose, you know, in a school you would, or like a home learning environment or whatever, you'd sort of go through the tasks and the cards in order. I kind of think of it as just like, it's kind of like a book that's been cut up into little like cards, basically.
And I guess if you think about, you know, kids sitting in front of an Apple II, you know, and asking them to sort of, okay, you know, you're sitting here with this computer, you've never dealt with this before, you've got a keyboard, flip through a book at the same time, keep track of what page you're on. It can make more sense to, okay, while you're sitting here this 45 minutes, these three or four cards I want you to work through and try these things out as a teacher. It makes some sense.
Yeah. And also books are sometimes kind of a pain to keep open.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting.
So what do you plan to do with these? You said you got some.
Oh, I plan to scan them. That's basically
cool.
It. I might read them. But but it was sort of an interesting thing anyway. What else? Oh yeah, so just last night, this one definitely, when I was like looking for things to put in the eBay lists, I came across a relatively cheap TI Compact Computer 40. I've been sort of looking at these for a long time, but they're always just like, they were always more expensive than this one, basically. So I went ahead and bought it and bought a power supply that would go with it. But now this is coming at some point. But now I have to try to figure out what to do with this. And so I don't know. Do you know anything about this computer?
There's a whole bunch of peripherals for the CC40, and you can't have any of them.
Yeah.
Because they're basically, they're not out there. I have a CC40 that one of the RetroBits listeners a long time ago had sent me one that was new in the box. And I played with it quite a bit, but one of the limitations that it does have is no way to store the programs. So you mentioned this HexBus interface, and there's another TI that uses HexBus, isn't there? Doesn't the 994A have some sort of, I don't know, TI people, slap me around. Let me know what the truth is on this.
Right.
But I've heard tell of projects of people that wanted to build some sort of a HexBus-style interface so you could do things with the CC40, but... I don't know of any tangible projects for it. So I think it's just the computer. If we want to do something with them, we're going to have to do it ourselves and connect it up. You know, and the computer itself is rather modest, just having, is it a single line LCD display that's on it?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's something, I think that is correct. Yeah.
So it's kind of like a super calculator. I showed it to my daughter.
Right,
she was
right.
Really excited about it because she loves calculators with lots of whiz-bang features. And I was like, well, this is a ginormous, you know, programmable calculator from back in the day. And it looks pretty cool. I mean, the form factor of the thing is really neat to look at. But I don't know about the peripherals, though. I don't think you're going to find them.
Yeah. I like the box. I don't, so unfortunately, you know, the one that I, the one that's coming to me, does not have the box. So, and I really actually, there's something that's just very pleasing about the box. If you ever have a chance to kind of like see, the boxes that go with the TICC 40, they're black and I don't know, the design is just very nice.
They are.
And the CC 40 itself is like this little, nice little silver thing. I really do quite like it. But yeah, so it is a supercalculator. It is like a weirdly limited computer. So,
right.
The thing about it that has always sort of stopped me before, you know, if it weren't cheap, I wouldn't have done this, but is that it has no connection to the outside world. The Hexbus was supposed to allow that. So you can get a modem, relatively easily. Those are out there, like a Hexbus connected modem. But you can't. What I would like to try to find is an RS-232 connection, because at least, you know, that you could connect to other things. I believe that Hexbus is antecedent to USB. I think this actually is like the same team. I think that was the idea behind it. And I'm pretty sure that. Well, okay, so I only looked into it a little bit, but I'm not sure that the Hexbus connector actually did come out on the TI-99/4A. I think it's one of those things that almost made it out. But, you know, so basically what the task is going to be with this thing is to figure out a way to talk to the Hexbus connector, possibly with something that isn't an actual, like, you know, old-timey device. But if I can hook up, you know, something, some sort of microcontroller or something to it.
Yeah, it'd be fun to try and bit bang that Hexbus protocol. See if you could. Yeah.
But it seems like the community is small that works on these CC40s. Because generally, I think right now what you do is if you want to share a program with the CC40 community, you share with them the text file that they will need to type in on this dumb little keyboard.
Mm.
Because you know, they can't load it from anywhere. You can't save it on anything. So,
very weird. I read that the Byte Magazine review of this said the keyboard is vile.
Yeah, but it does look nice. I mean, it is.
It looks great.
Yeah. So, anyway, we'll see. We'll see what happens with that. But
they're neat and arguably more usable than some of the other. I mean, you guys remember from Casio or Radio Shack or Sharp, the one-liner pocket computer type of things that were also basic programmable and that. But so they might call that keyboard vile, but there are various levels of vile. Vile, viler, vilest, you know. And this is not near vilest, I would say.
Good.
Yeah, I think it comes out best in the calculator space. Like, if you think of it as a calculator, it's great. If you think of it as a computer, it's kind of ridiculous. But
that's a good point.
All right. Anyway, so that's basically what's going on here. And I guess that's it. So that'll be it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at ecfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast and tweet at us your suggestions and comments. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast or send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And so, until next time,
Retro Compute!